Welcome to Make Ready episode number 3. Thank you for listening in. I'm your host, Duncan Robertson. On this episode, I'm speaking with Garth Walker. Garth Walker founded two of South Africa's best known and respected graphic design studios, starting with Orange Juice Design in 1994, which was eventually acquired by Ogilvy South Africa. He then founded Mr. Walker in 2008. Mr. Walker designs for many of South Africa's notable corporate and consumer brands, in addition to a few select international design projects. He is also widely acknowledged for his interest in developing and encouraging a design language rooted in the African experience. Since 1995, now with 24 issues under his belt, Garth has published Africa's only experimental graphic design magazine, iJuicy. You can find links to iJuicy on the Mr. Walker website. Over the years, he has been widely recognized with over 100 design awards published in something like 80 magazines and books. He has worked in the collections of the Museum of Modern Art, Bibliothèque Nationale de France, Victoria and Albert Museum, the Smithsonian, and numerous university and academic collections worldwide. Now, here I feel like I should say something about the end. If it sounds like I'm trying to rush to the end or shoo him out the door, believe me, that is not the case. We were trying to squeeze this interview in between a talk that Mr. Walker gave at Texas State and a dinner that he was going to have with the faculty, and I was trying to be conscious of how much time we had because I knew people were waiting on him. So I hope that doesn't come through too poorly in the recording. This was a fascinating conversation, so I won't delay any more with me at the top of the show. Here is my conversation with Garth Walker.
Initially, why did you decide to be a graphic designer in the first place?
Well, sort of graphic design found me, really. Like many designers, I was useless at maths and science.
No. Okay.
Which is actually not true, because most designers are actually quite good at maths and science, because a lot of graphic design is quite mathematical and scientific.
Yeah, it seems to
It's this sort of education thing that, you know, you don't have a... You're not one of those clever Trevor types of numbers that we're kind of like going to be an accountant from day one.
So, sure.
I ended up sort of as a disaster at school, and that ended up impacting on what I could do after school.
Right.
So my parents, in desperation, asked me, they got me to do an aptitude test, and the aptitude test came back and said industrial design. But in South Africa, this was in the early 70s, there was no such thing as industrial design, but there was something called graphic design, which had previously been called commercial art.
Yeah.
And the best school for graphic design, in fact, I think it might have been the only school, happened to be in Durban.
Okay.
So I moved from Johannesburg to Durban. I did national service. Every South African had to do army in those days.
Sure.
I did army first to get that out of the way, my 1 year national service. Fortunate for me, because I missed the going into Angola and all the stuff that happened in the 76 odd Soweto included, et cetera, which would have been hugely problematic if I'd been eligible for national service
then. Yeah.
So having got that out of the way, I went to art school to do graphic design.
Cool.
And then in those days, we did a grounding year, which was a general year. You could literally do anything after that. So you did this general year, and then you could specialize for 2 years in textile design, graphic design, interior design, ceramics, graphic art, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it seems
so
like
I took
some
graphic
schools.
Design because it's sort of something I vaguely understood, and more importantly, at the end of it, you sort of could get a job.
Yeah.
Which was less the case with some other.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely aimed at making money more than other
creative endeavors are. Was sort of, and most, you know, designers was sort of, you went into an ad agency as an art director, even though you trained as a designer. So that was a sort of suggested career path. But I never took to art directing in the ad agency sense.
Sure.
So I never ever worked for ad agencies.
Yeah.
To this day, I still see myself as a designer rather than an art director, even though I have to do quite a lot of art directing because clients want you to do everything.
Yeah, there's a crossover, but there's definitely a difference. So when in your background that I've read about, you established orange juice design, and then went from there to Mr. Walker. So how soon
well,
after?
Yeah, school? Well, I mean, after art school, 76 Soweto, so the country was up in smoke, and we had this kind of low-grade civil war, and everyone was in denial. The property market collapsed. There were no jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So getting employed was very difficult. And my mother, actually, who was a tough cookie, managed to get me an interview with a printer. And I was horrified. I said, I'm not going to work for a printer. You know, I'm a graphic designer. And I was top of my class and won all these scholarships. And, you know, suddenly I was going to work for a printer.
Sure.
But anyway, I went for the interview. And they said, well, we want a designer to design all the stuff that we will print.
Right.
And I took the job and I ended up there 16 years. It was a family print business that eventually got out of print and sort of became a small ad agency. But what it did do is that I learned everything there was to learn about print. I learned everything there was to learn about design because I had to design everything known to man, including doing radio campaigns, fashion shows, TV commercials, et cetera, et cetera, on a small scale.
Sure.
And then it got to the point where I realized that I had to get out of this family printing business. So it became more important to leave than what I became after that.
Yeah.
So I left and I spent a brief period where I was headhunted by an ad agency, which was an absolute disaster. So that left only one thing to do is to kind of go on my own. So that's when Orange Juice started and the name came about because we had to submit at very short notice, 5 names to the registrar of companies to get the company registered. And that's the one they came back with to say, you can have this one.
Yeah, it's not used before or anything
so
like
all
that.
So all the other names, I can't remember what they were now. So we sort of became that by default. And then shortly after I'd started that, I was acquired by Ogilvy South Africa. They
were
looking to add design to their skill set, as it were. So we became part of Ogilvy, which I was part of for 10 years, and it never worked. So at the end of 10 years, we had an amicable parting and I went off on my own again, and everyone said to me, because I was well known, that I need to use my name.
Sure.
So because I was originally going to be Texas Ranger, Walker Texas Ranger. So I was going to call myself Texas Ranger because it's a cult TV program in South Africa.
All
the blacks love Walker Texas Ranger. So it became Mr. Walker simply because it was the easiest. I didn't want to have Garth Walker design, so you know, it's not an easy thing to, because people don't understand it as a name. They think you're using your name, not the name of a studio.
Yeah, I mean, my father had a similar, when he went out on his own, he went and hired a big agency in California to name his consulting business, and they came back with the Robertson Group. And my brother and I are just going, they couldn't come up with anything better than that. You know, how much did you pay these people? But it ended up working really well because it got to the point that it was him, you know.
Okay.
But it was still professional because it wasn't just
Well, it sounds name. Sort of like there's, you know, there's more than one.
Sure,
know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm kind of, I, you know, whether Mr. Walker's got 10 behind or he's on his own, but, you know, but eventually you end up, that's what you kind of known as, so you have to stick with it.
Yeah.
You can't chop and change.
So you've kept it pretty small, though, you said?
Yes, well, you know, that's really more of a result of the meltdown than anything else. Okay. So in South Africa, like everywhere, you know, 2008, it hit us, and the project work disappeared overnight, and the property market collapsed, and I did a lot of work in property developers. So it's just really been 4 years of surviving on what you can.
Yeah.
And as people left, I didn't replace. That's kind of got down to me. And then also with the rise of telecommunications now, it's become so easy to work with people that aren't physically in the same
office. Yeah. It's kind of evolving by necessity and technology.
And I've always been a collaborator, so I do quite a lot of projects with other disciplines and other organizations that might not necessarily be designers or an ad agency, but they need, you know, I handle the branding component of that.
Put it
that
way. So predominantly,
it takes me
branding.
To retail and architects and things like that. But the graphic design component, Garth will do. So
okay,
that's where I get called in.
So when you have in your talk, you talked about this kind of split between your personal work and the more commercial looking side of the work. Does all of that work go through Mr. Walker, or do you do some of it on your own without the rest
of
the
studio? Well, it all goes through the studio, and then as much as it, you know, that's the kitchen. So all the meals get cooked in the same kitchen.
Yeah.
They might get eaten in different rooms thereafter.
Sure.
And even the, I mean, you know, the commercial work, very few come to me to, for the African aesthetic, let's call it, to oversimplify things. Because it's undefined, no one knows what it is. And if they do have some inkling of what it is or isn't, they, generally speaking, don't want to go anywhere near it.
Yeah.
So South African business has this thing that we're a world-class business, so we must look like New York. So can you design a logo that looks like New York?
Yeah.
And that's what they want to have, and that's what they're prepared to pay you for. NGOs and cultural organizations often have a mandate or see the point of difference as being reflecting who they are, which is African.
Right.
Which then gives you an opportunity to explore a different aesthetic. And then because I publish this magazine, that's really the platform to kind of do your own thing, and you discover that there's a lot of other people out there that also want to do their own thing. And you've provided them with a mechanism to kind of be out there.
Have you found that the magazine is a way for you to promote your own style and your own work that you want to do? Or I'm assuming it didn't start as that. It started as a way to express yourself, but then obviously people like it and people have been talking about it. And has it brought you people who want work in that style?
No.
No.
It lives in its own world. So the magazine's taken on a world of its own, which arguably is what got me here.
Sure.
As opposed to a logo that I did for a commercial client or a book that somebody said, "You, who designed this book? Oh, we must bring him to Texas." Mm-hmm. So the magazine indirectly, because it explores this so-called African aesthetic, and there's nothing else like it out there. It is unique. There's no other thing exists covering the same ground. And I'm a survivor. So I've sort of like hung on and kept it going. We're now doing the 28th issue, which in self-publishing is kind of in some ways unheard of. I mean, even Emigre got to 60-something or other, or 70, and called it a day.
Yes, right around there.
So I haven't kind of got to 70, but they publish more regularly than me, and theirs was on a much stronger commercial footing. It was a commercial venture. Mm-hmm. Mine isn't. Mine's completely uncommercial.
So are you doing them annually or two a year?
Well, we did two a year. Now it's sort of like kind of got to one a year, because I used to get paper-sponsored and print-sponsored. Now that's all gone out the window. So I've got to find the money first, too, and it's relatively speaking quite expensive to produce it. The only variance has been we've done one or two issues where we've been approached by someone to say that they want to do cover a specific subject in that style. And the deal is that I will put together the magazine, find the designers, get all the work in, put it together, and it goes out under the banner of Ejuicy.
Okay.
So it retains its name. And they pay for the printing, but they don't pay for anything other than the physical cost of producing it.
Almost like an artist commission, where they're coming to commission you to do what you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, what I would obviously like to do is to say to them, yes, we'll produce it for you, but, you know, you benefiting from the brand and the history and the heritage. So, you know, I want $1,000 to print it, and I want $10,000 as a design fee, and that goes towards sustaining it. And that hasn't happened, but how we've managed to sustain it is that we moved into art publishing.
Okay.
So we publish, we've done two now, together with a partnership with a gallery, we published the Juicy Artist Portfolio.
Okay.
The first portfolio had works from the first 25, I think it was, issues, a selection, that were then reproduced as a work of art, an individual, frameable, archival, blah, 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 blah.
For a
produced
gallery.
At massive expense, signed by the artist.
Yeah.
And those were sold commercially. You know, SF MoMA bought one, MoMA bought one. I mean, half the museums in America bought, because it was a very cheap entree for them to get South African artworks in their collection.
And a sampling of what's cost. Coming from there.
And also it was ready-made. They got 10 works of art. They were by artists that they knew. And then we the second one, we then upweighted that, and we had a selection from designers that we'd worked with that hadn't been published in the magazine. So the second portfolio doesn't have stuff that's appeared in the magazine, but it's by artists that have contributed to the magazine in the past, together with invited big name, high profile South African fine artists like William Kentridge and Roger Ballen and David Goldblatt,
okay,
photographers. And because it's non-commercial and it has a history of for the public good, if you will, is that artists are very happy to contribute. Yeah. And that wouldn't be the case if, there was a commercial.
Right, if it's a Nike, I'd use it, yeah. So you've made this separation then in your studio of kind of work with a personal expression in it and work for pay, in a sense, it sounds like. It seems like a pretty kind of clear-cut business decision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd love to be able to have the personal / African aesthetic on a financial footing, but that hasn't happened. And, you know, as we progress post-democracy, that is less and less likely.
Yeah.
South Africa as a country missed the opportunity to do the kind of post-Russian Revolution 1970 new social order, new visual order. We didn't have that. We had new social order, so now let's look like New York. That's basically what
it almost looked like, looking at the work that you had to show, that maybe the chance to do that was the World Cup, where the chance to have big international exposure.
Didn't happen. Yeah. And that didn't happen for two reasons. That first of all, the people that were pulling the strings as to what got produced for the World Cup or what didn't were not interested in the African aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then the commercial components of FIFA behind that was such that, you know, they wanted to make sure that whatever was done was, you know, in FIFA's interests.
Yeah, FIFA is notoriously a mess. Yeah. I think I may have been the only person in the room that actually follows all of that. Oh, and okay. I keep up with it pretty closely.
Yeah, we were a soft target for them. Is that South Africa was a walk in the park. We got led by the nose because we had, look, there were good and bad. So it was a huge positive for South Africa. You know, everyone was predicting that everyone would get murdered and guys would have to kind of like, you know, you have to take guns when you go there and all that. It never happened.
Yeah.
So globally, it was a massive positive for South Africa.
Right.
But for us South Africans that have to pay for it and for future generations, it was like the Montreal Olympics. You know, we're going to be copping up for the next 200 years.
Yeah. It seems like there's that argument most places that look at hosting Olympics a World Cup or the Olympics. Yeah.
It's not viable for certainly emerging countries. You know, if you, the UK or America, you can do it. But when you sort of, you know, Spain or Greece or South Africa, it's not viable.
Yeah.
But the politicians, it's not their money, you see. And they get all the stamps. So they imagine they're going to be shaking hands with gold medal winners. What's not to like?
Yeah. So, it's all glory for them.
As I said, it's human nature doesn't change. That's all about it. Human nature has nothing to do with design.
Right. Yeah. So in the sense of making those kind of business decisions for everything, and having a smaller studio, do you handle most of the business side of
what the studio does? All of it. So if you phone me, I answer the phone because I'm the only one there.
Okay.
I do the quotes. I do the invoicing. I outsource all the financials. So all the books and that are outsourced, which is the best move that I ever made.
Yeah.
And I would outsource the admin or have someone come in to do the admin, but there's not enough of it to justify employing someone.
Yeah.
And I work on a software platform that was developed for ad agencies that integrates job bags, briefs, tracking, artwork, suppliers, PO numbers, et cetera, so all the admin of running an agency or a studio can be done on one website, and it's very simple, and it's cloud computing, so I don't even have to archive it.
Did you carry that over with you from the ad agency when you were working
there? Yes, it started there. So Orange Juice had it. So when Orange Juice, we just shut it down. I moved onto Mr. Walker and I took it's called Chase as the software platform. The Chase platform came with me. And then at the end of the month, you export all the month's admin. It's got a facility that allows you to export, and then it generates a file that can then be opened up in Pastel, which is the accounting software.
Okay.
So all the information that I've got in terms of admin is identical to the financial information. So it doesn't sort of lose a dollar here or add one there or anything. So you can keep an accurate track, and then the accountant guys then do their bit, and then we meet once a month to
Great.
Have a look at the month.
So I guess then you learned how to handle the business side of things with your experience at the ad agency, and then...
I've always, even under Orange Juice, Orange Juice ran for about 15 or 16 years. I ran the business.
Did you kind of figure it out the hard way, or did you have someone train you to do it?
You learn the hard way. That's why, it never really worked, because I'm not a businessman. And if the benefit of hindsight, knowing what I know now, I would have played the game differently, which may have had a different outcome. But I wasn't prepared to, I was the romantic designer and building a culture and that sort of thing. And that was at odds with the Ogilvy sort of a corporate thing, which is very business-like.
Sure.
And because I was very much the junior partner, basically they were calling the shots.
Right.
In my case, I didn't really call the shots. I didn't sort of like interfere. But I made some decisions and allowed certain things to happen that were not in the business's best interest. They were in the interests of design or the staff or people or something other.
Do you feel like when you started Mr. Walker, you had a chance to kind of start clean and make some of those decisions?
I think the other thing too is you've got to learn by your mistakes. So if I get to the same thing where I've got, 12 people, at one stage I had 26 people in 3 offices.
Wow.
You've got to learn by that. I don't ever want to kind of get back to that again, because basically you become a manager.
Yeah. Yeah. I've read that once you get over 10 to 12 people, that you get to the point where you cannot work yourself as a designer anymore. You have to dedicate your time.
You've either got to get a manager and you carry on as a designer and they manage the business, which has its own pitfalls, or you become a manager and you're no longer a designer. And that's what happens to most design guys. They become a manager.
Yeah. And they have to figure out that balance, or they have to...
Well, it's got no option. Yeah. But those people tend to be, if you get to 12 people and then you expand, it means you're quite good at the business side of it.
Yeah.
Which means is that you're probably doing what you're better suited to anyway.
Sure.
And that's very much I hate to use the word sort of like American or kind of British model. The European model is still very much more small studios. Mm-hmm. One or two designers or design an assistant or two assistants and a small client base, which tend to be not corporate.
Yeah, we did a trip with school this last summer. We went to Germany and Holland, and it was nice to see, that there are these designers like Lucas de Groot and the guys at Underwear. It was a typography class. We went to type design studios, and that they're in there working with maybe 3 people.
Yeah.
And they're internationally known, very well-respected designers around the world, and that they're not having to work in a studio that's so big that it's oppressive. I'd like to see that model here more. Hopefully we can get that kind of working.
So they make some of them a good living, a decent living. They can, pay the bills, educate their kids, but they don't make money.
Yeah.
And to make money is that you've got to go volume, and you have to have corporates, and you have to have retain income business. So you have to have clients that, every month you kind of like doing stuff. Then from an economic standpoint, that becomes a kind of a different sort of animal. And I think your design changes as well.
You become a
different kind of designer doing different kind of design work. I've never come across a large studio doing really great work in design terms that's also making huge money.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me to my next question about, because you have this divide between the commercial and the personal work in the studio, do you feel like you divide the way you handle the projects and that you have a kind of commercial approach to where you're not trying to... It seems like a lot of designers struggle with expressing themselves through the work that they need to make the money. And so then that seems to lead to conflict with clients or issues where they feel oppressed by a client that's trying to make them change something that they don't want to change. And it sounds like you've got a setup where you can take a more pure professional approach to your work with commercial clients and not have your feelings hurt so much if they're pushy about things.
Well, I think, that's why I say what we do is kind of like very hard, and designers are not for sissies and don't behave like a prick, because, you know, it gets no one anywhere. It doesn't get you as the designer anywhere. The client's not going to love you. And you're doing a disservice to other designers if you start behaving like a prick. And then you've got to understand it's only graphic design. So, you know, as I say to designers, you know, you can stab yourself, commit harikari, you're going to bleed all over the floor. And no one gives a shit. They're going to look at you and say, what is this guy doing on the floor? There's like blood everywhere. And they're going to carry on with life as it was. You know, George Louis, the famous American art director, was doing this stuff, you know, like in a... get out onto the ledge of the 93rd floor, and if you don't buy the campaign, I'm going to jump off. And that's I found that sort of like doesn't work.
It's melodramatic.
And if designers forget they're designers and they just think that they're kind of like ordinary people, and this was the pool guy or the restaurant owner or something or other, you know, you start looking like a bit stupid. I mean, what are you making such a huge fuss about? So I think a lot of it depends on the things. I think most designers are not confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
By nature, it's sort of thing, but
some
are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a confrontational designer, you might want to huff and puff, and that works for you. I'm not a confrontational guy, and huffing and puffing doesn't work for me. And at the end of the day, you know, I want to get rid of the client, get the job out of the way, get paid, and move on. And then sometimes in order to do that, you got to, you know, eat the poo sandwiches, as we say, and swallow hard, think of England, and just sort of get on with it.
Yeah.
And you find, you know, as you get older, you kind of get a bit wiser, so it's a bit easier to navigate the rapids. You can spot the problems earlier than perhaps when you're young, and you know which clients to avoid. And or if you don't, you go into it with your eyes open, and you know this is going to be a rocky road, but there's some money at the end of it. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you end up, you've got school fees to pay, you've got a mortgage, you know, you need money.
Yeah.
And that's the trade. And that's where, if you don't have personal work, that, you know, shit happens. And that's where I think a lot of designers end up bitter and twisted, because they don't have a personal
outlet.
So they can't have the, well, you know, I have to eat the poo sandwiches, but, you know, now I can do this fun stuff.
Yeah, they don't get any silver lining around their poo sandwiches.
Get off on that.
Yeah.
And I think that to do that personal stuff gets much harder if you, like, 12 designers and you're the successful businessman and your design business is now making real money.
Yeah.
You don't have the time, and, you know, you're doing something kind of else.
Yeah. You mentioned that with experience, you learn how to navigate a little bit better. Do you have any typical red flags that you run into where you see the client is somebody that you just
I think first of all is that, you know, clients reveal their hands fairly early on. So clients that start kind of coming along the line is that, you know, I'm quite creative, or I'm a bit of a designer, my wife's a bit of a designer.
Mm-hmm.
But so you have to start saying to yourself, well, if you so think, why can't you do this? Because most clients would do it themselves if they could.
Yeah.
In fact, 99% of them, if they could do the job, they would, because it's fun and sexy, and, you know, they can be a bit creative. When you get a client that says, look, this is not what I'm good at, I want you to do it because you're the expert, then, you know, you.
Yeah.
And then kind of like guys that, you know, everything is about the price. So, you know, they see it as a kind of a commodity. So, you know, how much do you charge for a logo? Oh, no, I couldn't possibly pay that for a logo. Yeah, it's fairly sort of evident. The other thing that I've learned is that you can start off all kuchi kuchi koo and it's sweetness and light and lovey dovey and what have you, and it can go pear shaped quite quickly.
Yeah. What do you do then?
Well, you've got to try and unpear shape it, or get out of town, or call it a day. And, you know, I think it's hard to do is to fire the client before they fire you. So that, I think, is the thing that you've got to look for. If it's going down a road where you know it's going to end badly, you've got to move very quickly to end it.
Yeah.
And the client's probably trying to do the same thing. And it's difficult because you get waylaid by the, you know, well, they haven't paid you, and there's quite a lot of money in this, and you invested quite a lot of thing, and there's your own ego. Sometimes it's just better you've got to park all of that. And I got my gallery partner, who had a very successful agency business, is very good at that sort of thing. He's very good at disciplining clients. And by saying, we're going to end it here and now, suddenly he, 9 times out of 10, the client changes their tune very quickly and gets a bit of a shock and says, oh, Jesus, you know, that doesn't suit them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been able to kind of be that confrontational with clients to kind of end it sooner rather than later. So you end up unhappy and they end up unhappy. I mean, I've got a situation like that at the moment with one huge big multinational client that I don't want to carry on, but we in the middle of no man's land. So I don't want to end it now because they owe me money.
Yeah.
But I know that I should.
Right. So then
say, look, this is not working for you. It's not working for you. So let's just kind of like walk away.
So you're looking for an end point.
Yeah. Well, you have the fantasy is that, you know, that you end this one and then they come back with another job where you tell them, no, you don't want to work with them anymore. But, you know, that's the designer fantasy we all have. You know, everyone wants to be one that ends the relationship. You don't want your girlfriend to tell you, you know, like,
right,
you got bad breath and I'm out of here. You know, Jesus, I wanted to do that.
Yeah, we all want to be the one. You know, we're all human. That's the human nature thing. Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with design. So, you know, ending the relationship is about how do you do it, when do you do it, and there is no pretty ending. You know, it's always going to be bad for someone.
Right. So you went through some of these in your talk, but I maybe we can recap one or two for the interview. What would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned as a designer?
There's so many of them.
Maybe a few.
Well, as some of the things that I kind of like touched on is, you know, things like, you know, what we do, it's not a science.
Yeah.
In that respect, it's kind of art because it's a word that kind of everyone understands. But I don't think what we do is art. But I think the process of creative problem solving falls into the realms of art. It's this kind of nebulous thing, but people like it to be scientific because they can then understand it. So the trick and the thing that every designer's got to learn is that how do you make the art retain its artness, but there's a scientific underpinning that the clients can get their teeth into, and depending on how you fiddle with that kind of combination determines how much you can push the boat out, how successful you can get the design to be, how much the client will buy. And that's something that comes with age. And also there are people that are very good at doing that. I've met guys that are not good designers, that are not great people guys, but they're very good at selling creative. They've just got a knack about of how to do it. And those are the kind of guys that ad agencies need to snap at. Designers, I find, is a bit more like the doctor. People want to talk to the doctor. They don't want to talk to the nurse.
Yeah.
So designers are a lot more direct. So there's designers have to be a lot more than just designers. And I think a lot of guys see themselves as, I'm just a designer. I'm going to sit behind my Mac and I'm going to create this amazing art.
Yeah.
And the reality doesn't work that way.
There's a lot more to it. And that's kind of where this all comes about, is that whole idea that if you really want to be a designer and you're in school to be a designer, or you've just come out of school and you want to go on to work, there's a lot more to it than just sitting behind your Mac and kerning.
A lot of non-design things. And I think
when
you suddenly discover that there's a whole lot of other non-designs that are completely unrelated that you have to be good at, they in turn make you a better designer. Because design is not different to architecture. You know, you look at the analogy of architecture where you're building structures for the human condition. You know, the more you know about the human condition, the more you're going to be able to use those ingredients in your architecture.
All those things are the ingredients.
So it's the chef thing, is that you know, you can't be a great chef only making pasta. So the more dishes that you can cook and the better you can cook those dishes, the better the chef you become, the more desirable you become as a chef, the better your restaurant, the more prices you can charge, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So it goes.
So in your experience, do those lessons that make you the better designer and the things outside of design, it seems like those only can come with experience, and it just comes with time.
Yes,
and
accepting that, you know, they're part of what design's about. So I think the first thing a young designer's got to learn is that it's not just about the type and the drawing and, you know, which photograph you use. It's all the other stuff. So you've got to be a psychologist, you know, a bit of an ex-murderer, you know, the devil incarnate, a lover. You've got to be all of these kind of things.
Yeah.
And you know, design is just kind of part of, design's the kind of glue that flows between all of those bricks. And, you know, ad agencies have got a bit thing, but ad agencies is much more of a kind of a commercial thing. You know, that's kind of like a service. And, you know, as I always think, that famous thing is, you know, designers are architects. We create the structure that's going to last 1,000 years. The ad guys are decorators. They come along and, you know, paint the wall orange and have the cushions to match it. But they don't see themselves as being that, but that is the reality. And the other thing I also tell people is that your mother probably knows the name of a famous designer and your Auntie Mavis, But they sure as hell have no idea about a famous advertising copywriter, creative director, executive creative director, all these stupid titles.
Yeah, sure.
They come up with. Even in places like London, is it, you know, the average London, they doesn't have anyone who's a famous advertising name, but they certainly know who Jonathan Ive is.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely, it's not a household discussion, typically. So, you said that there were some things that, if you knew then what you knew now, that you would have done things differently. How do you think you would have done things differently?
Well, I think, you know, it's to balance the thing is, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to decide whether you want to be a designer or working in a design studio where, you know, you do good work. You win awards, you get a paycheck, and that's kind of where it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody other else deals with the client, manages the business and what have you. But for good designers, that doesn't seem to work. Good designers yeah. don't want to stay. I mean, I'm quite friendly with Stefan Sagmeister, and he has these kind of like assistants, and he can handpick anyone he wants on earth and go and work yeah. for him. And it gets to the point where he feels that they've got to move on, and they want to move on.
Yeah.
So that's the one route. So, you know, you've got to work out where your talents lie and what you suited for. But the thing that I didn't know at the time is, you know, I saw this romantic thing. I'm going to be this designer doing this like amazing design work, and all the rest of that stuff doesn't affect me, and it's not part of who I am and what I have to do. And if I could start again, I would focus much more on making slight tweaks to the non-design stuff.
Yeah.
To make for a more rounded, complete meal at the end of it.
Okay.
So, you know, I think I've got to the point where we sort of made quite a nice cake, but, you know, you start wondering if you'd had some cherries on the top and a little bit of vanilla essence, it would have been even better.
Is that the designer in us all, though, that we always look yeah. back and say, couldn't we have done this better if we
And if we all had this other kind of non-design stuff. So, yeah. you know, if, for example, if in the kind of partnership is the most difficult thing to get right as a designer. Yeah. And I've learned a few things now about what makes a good partner that I didn't know when I was having partners until it was too late.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just one aspect. There's kind of a couple of other things, you know, all this like obsession with technology and you gotta have the latest Mac and all the typefaces and that's also sort of...
It's easy to get wrapped up in those things.
Yeah, that also doesn't really kind of like amount to anything. And, you know, to accept that, you know, we're just graphic designers. No one cares and no one knows who we are. But people are very envious. There's a lot of people out there that are hugely envious of what we do and how we do it, from the clients to, you know, your friends to family. Is, you know, we've managed to, through dint of, genetic transfer, we've been given a skill that's not given to everyone, and yet it's the outlet that everyone desperately craves is creativity and express your own individuality, etc.
It's interesting. It seems that, like, I see that too, that people all crave to do what designers are doing, but still design and designers are not a household conversation.
No.
It's interesting. You would think that, but in the same sense that people all wish that they were physically magnificent, you know, and able to be an actor or an athlete or things like that. And those professions are. I find that interesting, you know, and it seems like a lot of designers today are very focused on trying to achieve some level of stardom and fame as a designer. But you see that, I mean, even like you said, Stefan Sagmeister or Michael Byrd or Paul Scheer, none of these people that we are design studio household names, and nobody's mother knows who these people are.
Right. I mean, you know, Michael Byrd in the New York Times, you know, like it's run over by a bus. Who's he?
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a, you know, football star or a politician or a, you know, supremely... Yeah. Rich businessman, you know, like Steve Jobs. Everyone knows who Steve Jobs is, but you say Jonathan Ive outside of the design community, and most people, in fact, lots of people's mothers might not know who Jonathan Ive was. Sure. You say Steve Jobs is the guy that designed Apple. So yeah. Steve Jobs gets, you know, the iPhone. Oh, this
well, he gets
Steve
the credit for the design as well as everything else. Yeah,
that's the name that they know. But you know, maybe that'll change now that Jobs is gone. Who knows? But, you know, I think the sort of the fundamental thing is that, you know, you learn that what you thought it was and what you assumed and what you presumed and what you planned for doesn't happen, which has got nothing to do with design, actually. My father said to me, you know, life is something that happens while you're making plans to do something else.
Yeah.
And I think that's a truism of design as well. So, you know, as you carry on with this game, you discover that what you thought it was isn't what it is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of something other else, and that something other else is different for everyone.
That seems like a great piece of advice to pass on to other designers, and that's kind of what I planned on wrapping up on. It was a piece of advice for
other designers. You know, whatever you think it's going to be and whatever you presume and all the dreams that you have and that thing, it never turns out that way.
Yeah.
Something else. And you can, to some degree, control that something other else. And when you get to that, it's now something other else. Then you decide whether it's where you want to be or it's where you not want to be.
Yeah.
And that's true of design, but it's true for everything else too.
Yeah. Like
whether you're a housewife or a garage mechanic or a plumber, is you suddenly discover that this is not what I thought it was, and am I happy in the space or not? And that's to get back, you know, it's a loop. Gets back to the clients, is that most of the clients, they're in this place and they're not happy to be in that place.
Yeah.
But they see us as being the place they want to be. So there's a bit of projection there. And, you know, a lot of times I think, well, I'd quite like to be the client.
Sure.
Me. So it's, as I said, it's the human nature doesn't change. You know, design does and technology does, but human nature doesn't change. And I think designers need to focus a bit more on the human nature and basic psychology than, you know, what typeface and, you know, who's the latest, you know, web coder genius.
If we learn more about the human nature and psychology, some of those other decisions may be more self-evident.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much for sitting down to talk with me. I really appreciate
it. If you need any things, I mean, Amaya knows how to get hold of me. You can email me stuff. And
fantastic.
You know, I'm a good corresponder, so if you email me, I don't forget about the email, and then, like, oh, shit, we'll send you back a toast thing saying, oh, sorry, I'm busy at the moment, you know, mail me in a month.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
You know, and it goes around, comes around.
Maya has that. Maya has your email address.
Yeah. Because we've had quite a lot of contact. Goes around comes around. So I still think that, you know, the more you spread the love, the more it kind of comes back in design terms. You know, I wish I could say the same about, you know, if I gave every homeless guy a dollar that I'd get more money. But certainly in design terms, I've found the more you out there handing it over to anyone that wants it, the more it comes back.
I'm kind of counting on that with this project in mind, honestly, just because I think that in trying to get other designers to sit down and talk about their business and how they run things and how they got there and everything, a few of the people I've kicked the idea around with have said, well, why would they want to talk about that? Why would they want to give that away? And so I'm kind of counting on that idea, because I agree. I think that the more you share, the more everyone grows and the better everyone gets.
You know, there's another thing that I've discovered about design is that the really, really great designers are really, really nice people.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that they've learned how hard this is.
Yeah.
So it hasn't gone to their head that they think they've invented gunpowder. And in design terms, I mean, a lot of, and I won't mention any names here, a lot of designers were complete shits to their family and wives and kids and lovers and stuff like that. But to other designers, fantastic. So even then you get that split between some in the design context, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And really great people and they're fantastic designers, but their wives and girlfriends might not say that, or their kids. And then you get the others that the wives and the girlfriends do. But I don't think you get somebody that's of an exceptional talent as an absolute shit.
Sure.
It doesn't kind of go together. When I see that, then I get nervous. So now where's the con?
Mm-hmm.
Architecture, I see quite a lot of that, and advertising, but not design.
Yeah, it seems like it exists some places. But like you said, the more you learn about those situations, you always end up finding, oh, this is why. This is how that happens. Because, you don't seem to be able to get away with that very, very long.
You know, this is an industry that takes no prisoners. And, it is. Like all creative industries, if you in Hollywood and, you know, you win the Oscar, and as we all know, the best actors don't always win the Oscars. But, you know, if you've got a few dead bodies and, you know, some blood on the ground on the way up there, it can come around and bite you in the ass quick as a flash.
Sure. Karma.
Yeah, and there's a bit of that in design. You know, David Carson's the one who's like imploded. Is that he was a nightmare. He was a nice enough guy and that sort of thing, but he was a complete nightmare and treated everyone badly. And I don't know what's happened to him. He's disappeared.
Yeah, you don't hear about him anymore.
He's vanished.
Yeah.
So that was a phase. And, you know, you don't want to be the one-hit wonder that was, you know, big in Japan. One thing's and the next thing's, well, like, what happened to him? No one knows.
Right. Well, thank you again. Okay. I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad I got the chance to talk with Garth Walker while he was visiting. What great stories, insight, and advice. Make Ready episode number 3 was extra special. It's not every day I have a chance to sit down with a brilliant designer from such a faraway place. As usual, I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with Garth Walker. Please join me for the next episode coming soon, and remember, you get what you make. This is Duncan Robertson with Make Ready Podcast.